Welcome to Discovery 1, Revision Lecture 1. Now, the aim of this lecture is to cover any questions that student have, to clarify any confusion or attempt to clarify any confusion that students are having in the course, and to answer any questions you may have before you consider taking the final and for Discovery 1 and those sorts of things. Now, before I start inventing things to talk about, does anybody have any questions, concerns, queries that they would like to raise on anything that we've covered so far? I'm not going to go through the entire course, but I can sort of do a drop-through summary. I'd really encourage people to read back over their chapter notes if they want to or at least reread over the chapter summaries, and then if something doesn't seem very familiar to you, read the sections in the chapter. So any questions, queries, anything that people want to talk about this morning that we've covered?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to, you know, say that I've learned a lot, and then also I want to say that I want to ask about the descriptions for the exams for the final. Are there going to be any graphics on the final that I have to refer to?
Yes, there will be, most definitely. I think there's 3 or 4 graphics in the final. And unfortunately, the bad news I can give you guys is that the further on you go through the Cisco courses, the more graphics you are going to come across. We are in negotiations with the Learning Institute to embed the graphics into the exams. But until that happens, I'm sorry, you're just going to have to work with the doc files that have been put up so far. And yes, it will take you a minute or two to find the diagram description that you need, but because the questions are randomized, we don't have an easy way to get around that.
Oh, well, that's really sad to hear, because I just don't want to do so bad on the final. That's what concerns me.
No, there isn't a practice final for Discovery. There is one for IT, I think. Is there a practice final for Discovery, Ian, or not? I don't think there is. The fact is that there's a couple of... I mean, you don't have to take the finals until... If you don't feel that you're ready to take the final yet... and this goes for everybody, you don't have to take the final until late June, early July, because the actual course end date is... There is a practice final for Discovery, is there? Okay. There is a practice final, so we might be able to put the practice final up and you can have a shot at that. But you don't have to have the final done until... mid-July. We'd like to see everybody get their finals done by the 15th of July.
Okay, that...
I'm just trying to think how to answer the question. You can manually install the printer drivers if you have the printer drivers by downloading them from the internet. You go to the manufacturer's website and you download the printer drivers. The printer driver referenced in Lab 1.5.3, I think it is, you can actually do that lab by installing a text-only printer driver, if that's the only one you can find. But the actual drivers are embedded in Windows, and then you can actually go to the website and pull another driver down. Okay, just out of morbid curiosity, did anybody actually find that there was more work in this course than they thought?
Not really. The only thing I found is that with some of the Chapter 7 labs, I find that not having access to the equipment that I need to be able to do the labs is really a pain in the butt.
Good morning, Jonathan. You have just wandered in on a revision lecture where we get to talk to you about all of the things that you find confusing, or as many of the things that you find confusing that we have time to fit in. I will take a look at the Module 7 labs and see how imperative having the equipment is. I've got to look through the 7 and 8 labs and possibly redraft them for those who don't actually have the specific hardware that's required. But what we're finding is that a lot of students are having trouble with the workload, and a lot of students are having trouble getting the stuff done. And what we're thinking we might try and do for the next semester of intake is, if anybody's willing to participate, get you to talk to the future students and try and explain to them what sort of workload's involved and how much that you're actually going to have to do. It's very difficult for me to know how long it's actually going to take you guys to do this stuff, because I've been working in the industry for 15 years. But yeah, I've noticed that not necessarily the people here, but a lot of the people who had enrolled seem to be having trouble with the workload of the courses.
Well, my problem was that I was rushing too much. I thought I had to rush through stuff.
No, you've got until at least the 15th of July. So what is it now, May? That's still a couple of months away. Better to be the tortoise rather than the hare.
Okay, because I spent a whole weekend doing labs, and I just submitted one after another, and it was kind of hard to do.
I think we'd all prefer that you take your time with the labs, and even if you only submit one, if you actually spend the time to work on that lab and fill it out completely, that'll cut down the number of resubmission cycles, and you'll be happier, and I'll be happier. Yeah, I thought that might be the case. What can I say? We've almost finished Discovery, and you almost have finished. So you can talk to us on Skype about what you want to do. If you want to put one of the classes on hold, you can do that and finish off the other one. Or if you just want to knock these both over and then only take one more course in future, that's certainly an option. But we can talk to you individually on MSN or Skype about that. No need to put that on the lecture recordings at this stage. But yeah, I thought there is, if you're doing both courses, there is a fair bit of work. And we did try and sort of mention that when people were enrolling, but you never really know until you get started. It's sort of one of those things that once you sort of get into it, you go, ooh, okay, there's a bit of stuff to do.
I have a question to ask, because I had previously taken Cisco 1 with my instructor at Louisiana Technical College, and I was wondering if I enroll, because I enrolled here also. What I was wondering is if will this actually go toward a credit that I can transfer over to that school?
No, because you've taken it already at Louisiana Tech.
You've already passed.
Okay.
You can talk to your instructors about, and move that microphone a little further back as well. You've gotten loud again.
Okay.
Yeah, that's better. Talk to Louisiana Tech about what they want to do about that, because I mean, you are going to get the accreditation here.
Yes.
And if they want to take that particular mark instead of the one that you've already got, then that's up to them. But you may be already stuck with the mark that you've got from Louisiana Tech.
We're not going to give you a grade. We're going to pass fail and give you some marks in the lab book. We don't grade like they do. So. The one that you got from them will stay with them. You don't get an extra credit for taking the same class twice, just like you wouldn't get an extra credit for taking the same class twice at Louisiana Tech. It's the same thing.
Think of this as auditing.
Well, basically, yeah.
I don't understand your question, Sean. There's a cloud icon for the internet, and nobody seems to know what it is or have seen it. What's the... The cloud is a picture of a cloud, which basically looks like a big thing of fluffy cotton wool. and it's meant to symbolize all sorts of connecty, routy stuff that nobody really cares about. So basically, stuff goes in one side of the internet cloud. Whatever happens to it inside the cloud, we don't really care about. And then when it comes out of the other side of the internet cloud, it's obviously gotten to its destination. So it's a way of saying, it's a bit like if I posted a letter from my house to your house, we could post the letter. And in fact, we'll probably be posting your certificate. There's a good example. We're posting the certificate from your house, from my house to your house. We don't really concern ourselves with exactly how it gets there. We're just interested that we give it to like the local post office, and eventually it gets to you. So that's sort of like the postal cloud, if you like. In other words, it gets from one point to the other, but we're not really concerned about exactly how that routing happens when we look at the internet cloud.
That
Does that
makes a lot of sense. I hope you got that, whoever it was meant for, but it makes a lot of sense to me.
No, it isn't.
No,
There
it's not.
is no icons of the cloud on your computer, pretty much ever. It's just something that they use in the lab.
And the icon on the... Actually, does Internet Explorer still have a throbber, like a little colored icon that changes colors and stuff? Anybody know?
It's right now it's a blue icon. It's like a blue icon that's on the taskbar now.
What's a throb?
Well, in this context, it's the name given to the icon that sits on Internet Explorer that changes colors and stuff when things are happening to show people what is happening. They've probably renamed it now because I'm sure that's not PC, but it used to be called the Throbber, and it was an icon that changed colors and stuff. All a bit bizarre.
Fair enough.
Interesting name. Yeah, this is what I'm saying. They've probably renamed it now, but that's what it used to be called when I did TAFE back in 1995. Yeah, okay, so does that answer your question regarding the internet cloud, Sean? Okay, because I think it sort of does explain what the cloud is in the notes, but I'd assume that everybody understood that thing, and I didn't actually explain what a cloud was, which was a bit silly of me, but there you go, I have now.
I take it that, I mean, if there's one thing that I get, even if I don't get a grade for this course, retaking it with y'all, just the fact that I get the knowledge that I need makes a lot, the knowledge is more important than the grade, right?
Oh yeah, you're going to be a better technician for it.
Put it this way, Paul, if you don't get the knowledge in Discovery 1 in this course here, you will not pass Discovery 2. I guarantee it. So it's in your best interest to get this knowledge going through with us, and then you will be more equipped to pass Discovery 2. Otherwise, I would be very doubtful that you would get through Discovery 2 without doing the Discovery 1 first.
Well, I was taking Discovery 2 with my instructor, but I was having so much trouble, and he insisted I go with Discovery 2 because he said I had already taken Discovery 1, and the fact of the matter was that I had only gotten a C in the course, and the C was not.
Look.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Look, I'll have this conversation with you at some other point because I don't know. I mean, I don't know that it's appropriate for right now, but
Yeah, look, we can talk to you about this on Skype at some point, Paul. I mean, I understand your situation is unique, and we'll certainly discuss it with you. But unfortunately, your challenges are not going to help the rest of the class study for the exam. So we'll cover that with you off lecture later, and talk about the ramifications of that.
Okay, I was just wondering. Also, I was just wondering about that. I'm sorry if it's
No, not a problem. We will have this conversation.
Oh, okay. I just need to make sure that it will be had eventually.
Okay, I'm sure we will, and I'm sure we'll catch up with you, and we'll discuss that with you, and see what we can come up with regarding that. But I can tell you that taking Discovery 1 through us will allow you to get the knowledge that you will need to finish Discovery 2, regardless of whoever you take Discovery 2 with. So I personally don't believe it is a waste of time. You've gained a lot of knowledge coming through the course with us, and if we can keep that happening, you will be equipped to do Discovery 2.
Thank you. All I can say is thank you, Carrie, and the rest of y'all over at CAVI. I really appreciate it.
Good stuff. Okay, now, labs. Just putting this on the recording for anybody who might be actually downloading the recording and listening. You do have until July 15 if you want to go in the prize draw. Remember that for all students that complete all of their labs by the 15th of July, you go in a draw to win a mystery prize. And we will post you the mystery prize if you win. And you win a prize. So there you go. So there's
Am
a bit
I
of
picking
incentive.
Them, so they'll be really cool.
The prizes, that is, not the winners.
I have an announcement if nobody has... already spoken about this, the L7 presentation on Friday?
No, not yet.
Okay, we have Brett, I believe it is, coming from L7 on Friday to see how our academy works. And this guy is an excellent presenter. I'm not sure if he's presenting for us on Friday, but if he is, you guys are in for a real treat because he is very interesting and has a lot to say about workplace and what it can be like to work for an IT company and what workers are looking for. If not, hopefully he will come back to do that at a later date. He's really good. Carrie and I saw him speak a couple weeks ago. So you all should come. He's a very interesting guy and he wants to have a talk to you all.
That will be Friday morning when social would normally run from 9 p.m. Eastern, and I'll give you a world time link, timeanddate.com link, so that you can all look that up, and I will post to announce on that later. But it's when the usual social would run. Until you actually have something to say, Paul, please don't key up. You're keyed up at the moment.
I was going to say something. For anybody living in the central time zone in the U.S., it'll be about 8 o'clock Thursday night.
Okay, that's fine, but just don't keep yourself keyed up while you're... I've heard you key up, and I know you've got something to say, but please don't leave your microphone open because it does actually put some noise behind me on the recording, which is not so cool. Hang on, I'll just pull that question out of chat and answer that. Thank you for the time zone conversion, and I will also put the timeanddate.com link into the message that I post to announce today. I don't understand your question, Sean. I really don't understand your question at all. You don't change letters to binaries in Internet Explorer. I've never done that in my life. I'm really confused. If you're trying to look up the IP address of a website, then you'll want to be using NSLookup, and that will be covered in the lab in Chapter 4, and that does not use Internet Explorer. Does anybody know of any web-based domain lookup tools that don't require a CAPTCHA? If anybody finds any, let us know. There are tools that
You've got Salon and WebVision, though.
But if you're doing a couple of labs and firing in a couple of domain names and stuff, that's going to be very time-consuming to wait for the CAPTCHA solves. Okay, has anybody got any other questions they'd like to raise? Does anybody remember any of the course over the past 10, 11, 12 weeks? Do we basically remember what we covered? We covered basic networking, what a network was, how big networks were. You've got personal area networks, which are networks that exist on you within 10 meters. You've got local area networks, which are in within to about 100 meters. You've got wide area networks that are over 100 meters. We talked about all of that sort of stuff. Then in Chapter 2, we talked about general pieces of how networks work, how packets travel. We talked about how the packets were routed from their source to their destination. We talked about the IP addresses, source and destination IP addresses. Can anybody tell me how many bits are in an IP address?
32.
Okay. Then we talked about the OSI reference model, the 7-layer model that has physical, data link, network, transport, presentation, session, and application. Please do not throw sausage pizza away. We also talked about the TCP/IP model, which has 4 layers. It has network access, network transport, and application, with application being at the top and network access being at the bottom. And we talked about the reason that we had for having layered models is so that we could compare different protocols and we could break the protocol down into understandable units. We also talked about the fact that if we had a layered model, you could change the transmission medium, for example, and keep the packet formats and protocols the same, and it would only have to be the transmission medium that would change. It shouldn't matter whether you are sending packets over fiber, or whether you are sending them over Ethernet, or whether you are sending them over wireless. Anybody got any questions on that, or comments on that?
Can you redo the access and distribution layers?
I think we did do the access and distribution layers, didn't we? I'm just trying to remember. The distribution layer is the stuff that actually gets the packets around the internet, and the access layer is the stuff that actually gets you onto the network from a workstation level, if my memory serves. I don't believe that comes up in the final.
Good.
Okay. We talked about testing connectivity. We talked about the ping command. We talked about the traceroute command. We talked about path ping. Ping, if don't mean a thing if you don't get that ping, named after the sonar ping that you all see on World War II movies with bad German, where they're usually telling you that they're going down to the store to get some bread, which really translates into launch torpedo from tube number 3. You send out an echo request datagram, which is an ICMP packet, Internet Control Message Protocol, and the target host replies to that message, and you get to see the round trip time or whether the reply comes back at all. So there are labs that dealt with ping. You should all be fairly comfortable with opening a command prompt in Windows. Windows are CMD, hit enter, and then say ping space www.qcat.org. Anybody got any questions about that aspect of the course or that sort of bit of the lab as far as ping was concerned? Most people got ping to fly? Sean, a lot of your questions are read by listening to the previous lectures. Have you listened to the previous lectures yet? Okay, I'm sure we've covered this in the previous lectures. Packet tracer at this point is completely inaccessible. You will not, underline, not be using packet tracer.
Hello, can you hear me?
Certainly can.
I was looking at a flowchart about analysing troubleshooting on wireless networks, and I could understand all of it except that SSID numbers. Have we covered that?
Yeah, but this is a revision lecture, so I can cover it again.
Thank you, if you could, please.
The SSID is the service set identifier, and it is generally... It is generally the identifier for a particular wireless network. Now, if my memory serves me correctly, the ESSID is also known as the ESSID, which is the Extended Service Set Identifier, and that is the name of your wireless network. So whether your wireless network is called D-Link, Netgear, Cabbage, Parsley, Dead Cow, whatever you happen to want to call
mine
your...
Whipped Cream Mania.
Okay, so Rose's is called Whipped Cream Mania, and she'll be happy with that, but anybody who's using the command line will probably not be happy with that, because Whipped Cream Mania is a lot to type into a configuration file. But of course it's her network, so she can name it whatever she wants. I tend to keep the ESSIDs short, because there are times, especially if you have a hidden ESSID, when you actually need to type them in. And nobody wants to type in a 31-character ESSID on 6 machines. But if you don't have 6 machines, that isn't a problem. The ESSID is the name of the wireless network. It's what Windows says now connected to Whip Cream Mania, signal strength excellent. Or if you're on the Mac, it says something different, and I can't remember what it says, but it says something.
It talks about the SSID number, but you're talking about a name.
The BSSID is actually the MAC address of the wireless access point.
Okay, I'll reread it.
Okay, no worries. I'm just about to fire something into Google and see if I can get a reference to what you might be talking about. But essentially, wireless networks are known by their names, which is the ESSID. Then you have the BSSID, which is the basic service set identifier. If you have more than one access point, they combine together to create an ESS, which is an extended service set. You have more than one basic service set, and it's actually the MAC addresses. It's usually the MAC addresses of the wireless access points that make up the BSSID. Those are used if you are using wireless distribution system or similar things when you are actually connecting the wireless access points together. So say, for example, you want to extend your range or have more than one access point to cover a wider area.
Thank you. I was writing it down.
No worries. Yeah, an SSID is the name of a wireless network. All machines wishing to be on the wireless network need to have the same SSID. And that is a string of 1 to 31 characters, and it can include letters, numbers, and spaces. However, I would recommend against things like spaces because or punctuation and stuff, because it can be very difficult to input punctuation and weird things into a device, as anybody who has tried to join a hidden wireless network with an iPhone will tell you. Here we go. I'm just looking at an eHow article that does talk about this thing called SSID number, which seems to be a bit of a misnomer. So I'm just looking this up and finding out why they would actually call it a number, because my understanding is that the string actually makes it into the packets. It's not hashed into a number. I had no idea that the icon for a Windows wireless network was green radio waves. So there you go. That's something that eHow teaches you. Okay, anybody else got any questions before I continue my ad hoc summarization of the course content, which is the try to brain cram discovery in 20 minutes section?
That eHow you were talking about, is that a site with good answers, material, etc.?
It's a general site that gives you how-tos on just about anything. Cooking rice, brushing dogs, finding out what your SSID number is. It often shows up fairly high up in Google results when you Google how to do something. You'll tend to get some answers off eHow. And eHow is a wiki that is edited by the net at large. So your mileage may vary, but most of the articles tend to be fairly good. They're probably not technically accurate, but they are accurate enough for somebody who is trying to get a task done.
Is that ehow.com?
Yeah, I think it's I just closed the window. I think it's ehow.com.
I'm pretty sure that's right.
Yeah, ehow.com. The other thing I'd recommend is if you guys are having trouble finding information on things, there are a number of Thursday chats we have done on research methods. And in fact, one of the ones we did last year with Chris Legg and co. was a Google one that tells you how to do things like metric to imperial conversions, temperature conversions, and all sorts of other funky things on Google, which you can certainly find if you Google up some of the Engadget articles, but you're probably not likely to come across in your general travels. Of course, the other thing you can do is you can go to Google and key in find Chuck Norris, and the first result you will get says something along the lines of, you do not find Chuck Norris, Chuck Norris will find you. And that's the only result you get, apparently.
Most mobile phones, I've noticed, usually have some kind of a conversion utility.
Oh, they certainly do. I use the conversion utility on my Nokia to do fluid conversions, metric conversions, that sort of thing, temperature conversions. When you import an American, you have to do some temperature conversions because our temperature scale's just weird. Okay, I've just got some clarification on this for anybody who's interested. The basic service set identifier is used in ad hoc networks, and they are wireless networks that do not have an access point, and that's generally set to the MAC address of the card. The extended service set identifier is used when you have an access point. And it's the access point coordinates all access to the wireless network. And that article came from kb.netgear.com. It's result number 5 if you Google SSID number in Google. So if you all haven't guessed by now, IT isn't actually about knowing lots of stuff. It's about being able to look stuff up and look it up efficiently and quickly. It helps to know some stuff so that it can make looking other stuff up easier. But generally the key to being a good technician is finely honed research skills. Okay, so we're talking about Chapter 3, we're talking about layered models, we're talking about Chapter 4, we talked about ping. There's also another utility called Traceroute, which will show you the path that the packets travel from their source to their destination. Traceroute sends a UDP packet out on an unused port with the time to live value set to 1. Now, I don't think I've actually talked about time to live in these courses yet, and I'll get to that in a minute. When the packet reaches the... I'll tell you what a time to live is. A time to live is a field that's embedded in an IP packet that counts the number of hops that a packet has been through. The number of routers that a packet has been through. It's designed to stop packets from looping in a network. If you set up your routing tables incorrectly, it's possible to have a packet go from A to B to C to D to A to B to C to D to A to B to C to D and around and around and around and around. And we can probably show you how to do that in Discovery 2. And the TTL is designed to be decremented each time you pass through a router, and because the default TTL on most packets is either 32 or 64, when the TTL reaches 0, the packet will be discarded, so it stops packets from looping forever. I don't think I'd covered that before. I don't have memories of covering that.
You said 32 to 64. Is that hops or seconds?
Hops, and it can be 32 or it depends on the networking stack. It can be set as high as 255. Back in the early days of the internet, a host that was more than 30 hops away was considered unreachable, and you'll probably remember that from your Traceroute labs. It defaults to trying 30 hops max. I think Windows sets the TTL by default to 64. I don't know. I have to have a look at that. Yeah, on ping, TTL 128 under new Windows, is it?
That is where you set, if you want to set it higher, that you want to change the number of the hops, or the delimiter on the hops is -H switch.
It's what you can set the number of hops that Traceroute will consider to be a valid will be a valid path. So basically what happens is if it's more than 30 hops away, you've got to tell it to use more than 30 hops. Basically what happens with Traceroute is it sends out a packet with a TTL set to 1. When the packet travels through the first router, the TTL is decremented, and you end up with a time exceeded, ICMP time exceeded message being returned, and that is how you can tell how the packet is traveling. So your first packet is sent with a TTL of 1, it hits the first router, a time exceeded message is returned, and you find out where that router is. The next packet is sent with a TTL of 2, It then hits the next router along the path, so it goes through your first router and hits the second router. The time exceeded message is returned, and you see what the IP address of the second router is. If a router does not return the ICMP time exceeded messages, you will see asterisks in your traceroute output. This was documented in the labs for Chapter 4, but it's probably worth me talking about it as well, because some people find that easier to understand than actually sifting through the documentation. Alrighty, we also talked about the domain name service, or the DNS, or domain name system, I should say, which is the underlying infrastructure that resolves host names into IP addresses and IP addresses into host names. We talked about the fact that the DNS was hierarchical. There was a root domain, and then under the root domain you'd have your country top level domains. You have .com, .org, .us, .net, .info, .tv. I don't believe we have a .xxx domain yet. I think that's still been blocked by ICANN, but there were... Has it still been blocked? Okay, they tried to register a .xxx domain for sites that are not generally for family consumption. However, ICANN has refused to create a .xxx domain on the grounds that it doesn't feel that it should.
So who can register a domain name? I mean, if we wanted .afl... could we go ahead with it?
Okay, I just got some more background information, and I have heard your question, Jonathan. I'll deal with that in about 10 to 15 seconds. But the reason they actually rejected the .xxx domain was they thought that all of the sites that were into that sort of material would band together. And they didn't want that to happen, and they thought that it would actually sort of legitimise those sorts of sites and stuff to a degree. Okay, if you want to register a domain, you generally have to register... Well, actually, if you want to register .afl, I think it's $250,000 a year for a top-level domain. So, yes, you can do it. But I think that's a bit outside my budget, and it's probably outside yours too.
Not kidding.
Okay, but what you can do is you can register a domain under .com, .org, or .net. And those tend to be anywhere between $10 and $20 per year. Depending on who you register through, you can have certain accessibility problems. One of the people who I will not single out here has had problems adding A records to their domain because of the inaccessibility of the web interface. So it pays to end up with a provider that you can ring up or one that is quite accessible. I'm personally a big fan of packnames.com because it works on every browser on the planet, is highly accessible and works well. Their prices are also good, but that's just the one I use. You might find something else better. So to register a domain, you put down $10 or $20 US per year to do that, generally speaking. If you want to register .au, they tend to be more expensive. There are certain people who can help you do that, and we can certainly find you resources on that. Certain domains such as ASN are free if you can prove the fact that you are actually an association. Also EduAU is free if you can prove that you are an educational institution. If you want to register a domain for yourself, so say for example you wanted to register a domain for Jonathan Hickbed, for example, you could actually register jonathanhickbed.id.au for a very nominal fee, and that would be a domain that is tied to your name. There is also a .name domain, and there are people registering their names under that domain. I actually have Hoth, H-O-A-T-H, .name, which is the .name domain for my last name, so you can actually email me as kerry@hoth.name, which is kind of cool if you're giving somebody an email address. Ironically enough, you can also register Grace, you can also email grace@hoth.name, but that's just a quirk as to how my server's set up, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Okay, so... we talked about the DNS, and we talked about the NS lookup utility that can be used to query various aspects of the DNS. A couple of people had a little bit of problem with the NS lookup utility. I think most people got that resolved. If anybody has any problems, get in touch with me or ask me. It does work fairly well under Windows. And that is the labs in Chapter 4. So yeah, you can register your domains. Once you've registered the domain, you need to host the domain. And I went through all of that in one of the lectures, I think around about Lecture 4, I went through the entire procedure of how you'd get www.mywebsitereallyreallyrocks.com up and running in one of the previous lectures. So I can certainly find out which lecture that was if anybody's particularly interested. Otherwise, you may find it when you go back through the revision of the lectures. If anybody has a talking book player, such as the Victor Reader Stream and stuff, one of our students says it's very useful to re-listen to the lectures with the Victor Stream and to drop marks wherever we say something like that'll be in your test, and then that makes it easy to revise those sections of the lecture rather than listening to the whole lot. Any questions on DNS and NS lookup and all those sorts of things?
Wait a minute. Why
is anybody... Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. Why do you get two different responses when you NS lookup Cisco.com or www.cisco.com?
Ah, good question. Because they are two completely different things. Believe it or not, before 1993, we didn't have the World Wide Web and nobody cared about www. It just wasn't out there. You didn't have www.anything. A lot of people think that just because you have a domain, it has to be www.whatever. Because let's face it, there's nothing else on the internet except for the World Wide Web and Facebook. But the reality of the situation is actually that when you register a domain, so say for example we have registered the domain qcat.org, C-U-C-A-T, you actually have what we call glue records, which say qcat.org name server is nswhatever.zonedit.com. QCAT.org name server is whatever.zoneedit.com. Handy tip, zoneedit.com will host up to 5 free domains for you, and they will hold on to your DNS data. They'll charge you if you want to host web traffic, but you can actually host the domain data on zoneedit.com for free for the first 5 domains. Now, as well as having name records for qcat.org that says the name servers point to this and point to that, we can have what we call mail exchanger records, so that if you email kerry@qcat.org, it's how the email system knows which machines that email needs to be delivered to. And you can also have an A record which points to the actual root of the domain qcat.org. Now, generally speaking, the A record for qcat.org and the www record will generally point to the same place, but they don't have to, and there's no reason why they should. Because often you can have the A record pointing at a mail server for that domain, for the qcat.org domain, because some mail transmission software is broken. And then you can have the www being a canonical name pointing to another machine. Now, the good thing of having www as a CNAME is that when the web server goes down, you can bring up another web server, change where the CNAME points, and bring your website back online very, very quickly. So there is nothing magical or special or significant about www, except for the fact that that is where millions of people have their websites, and people expect to type in www.whatever. One of the things that we've actually had problems with, and she's not on at the moment, but Grace used to have this problem. Sometimes she would drop the www off a URL because she couldn't be bothered typing it, and she would actually get a completely different website, or she'd get an error, or it would take her somewhere that she hadn't intended to go. So the www is meant to signify this is a World Wide Web server. It's a bit like ftp.whatever, mail.whatever, pop.whatever, SMTP dot whatever, they're generally names for machines that provide a specific service on a domain. That was a bit long-winded, but I hope that answered your question.
Yes, it did.
It is actually perfectly legitimate to register a domain without www anywhere in it. Most people don't do it because everybody wants a website. But it is actually quite possible to run a domain that just handles email, FTP sites, and other things. You don't actually have to have a web presence. Okay, then in Chapter 5, we talked about all of the fun stuff with IP addresses. We talked about the fact that IP addresses had 32 bits. They were a big, long binary number. Generally speaking, they were written as dotted decimal notation, which was four numbers between 0 and 255 separated by full stops. For example, 192.168.1.1. We talked about the fact that there were different classes of networks. Class A networks could have 16.7 million hosts and were in the range 1 to 127. Class B networks could have 65,534 hosts, or 65,536 minus 2 for the reserved addresses, which we'll cover in a minute. And they were from the range 128 to 191. I don't believe you need to know these ranges for the final, but it is something you should be able to look at an IP address and look at the first byte and be able to tell what class of an IP address it is, probably by the time you finish Discovery 2, if you go that far. 192 to 223, which is Class C IP addresses, they can have 254 hosts. As previously discussed, there are two reserved... Well, I'll get to that in a second. The IP address is split into two sections, the network number and the host portion. The number of bits in the network number and the number of bits in the host portion is illustrated by the subnet mask, an example of which being 255.255.255.0. This says that the first three bytes of the IP address are the network portion and the last byte of the IP address is host portion. If you have a subnet that is a Class C subnet, you can actually have 254 hosts on that subnet. If all of the host bits are set to zero, this refers to the network or the network as a whole. So, for example, on 192.168.1, the network address is 192.168.1.0. The broadcast address is specified if all of the host bits are set to 1. And that sends a message to all hosts on that subnet, and that is 192.168.1.255 in our example. The masks for Class A is 255.0.0.0, Class B is 255.255.0.0, Class C 255.255.255.0. So A, B, C, 1, 2, and 3. Lots of 255 on the left-hand side of the subnet mask. Anybody got any questions about that or things that they would like me to clarify? This is probably not going to be the only revision lecture, but it just depends if anybody comes back with questions for me that they want me to do in this format. Otherwise, you can all have a quiet evening and or you can ask your questions individually.
What's a subnet mask of Class D or an E?
I would encourage you to go to en.wikipedia.org and key in Class D IP address. You won't need them for this course.
Okay.
I believe that the subnet mask for a Class D, which is multicast, is 240.0.0.0, and for experimental, I wouldn't know. Okay, we talked about the procedure for converting decimal to binary and binary to decimal, which I can go over if there's any interest, but I'd do that towards the end of a lecture in case there are a lot of people who weren't particularly interested in it. It is something that you will need to know by hand. If you intend to sit the Cisco exams, you will be provided no aids for conversion. I think we might be trying to work on getting pegboards in, but I'm not sure how that's going. So if you intend to sit any of the CCENT exams or if you intend to sit the CCNA exams or whatever, you will not be allowed to use Windows Calculator to do your subnetting work. You must know how to do it by hand. Otherwise, you will not pass the exam if you do the Cisco exams. Also, the other thing is you won't understand anywhere near as completely how the conversion process works if you just feed them into Windows Calculator. However, when working on your labs and stuff, you can check your work with Windows Calculator. If you want to change the bases in Windows Calculator, that can either be done under the View menu, or you can use F6 for decimal, F7 for hex, and F8 for binary, I think. I'll have to check that. If you are using Windows 7, you need to be in programmer mode in the calculator rather than scientific. So basically you press F6, key in a decimal number, then press F8, and the calculator will convert it to binary for you. Kind of cool, but you do need to understand the underlying procedure.
So they do allow you to bring a... Sorry, Jonathan, go ahead.
I was going to say, thank you. What exactly are you talking about? So that if we have the number FF, we can remember that's 255. But if somebody gave me CB, I wouldn't remember what that is.
You don't have to remember what it is. You could say, well, CB, C is 13, so 13 times 16 plus 12. And you could then work that out, and that would tell you what CB was.
Oh, joy.
The problem is that in the actual exam, they do not allow you to use a calculator. At home, you are allowed to use a calculator for adding the powers together, but you can also use your calculator for multiplication and stuff that's not easy to do. So, for example, you could actually do your 13 times 16... Actually, that wouldn't be too difficult. 10 times 16 is 160. 3 times 16 is 48. So that gives us 208 plus 11 is 219, I believe. So that's what CB is. And a correction, hexadecimal is F5. Ah, and I was wrong. It's 203. I apologise.
Isn't C12?
Yeah, it is, which is why I made a mess. I added one more lot of 16 than I should have. I was 16 out. So there you go. It helps to check your work.
They do allow you to bring a pegboard to the Cisco exams?
We're working on that. We believe it will be possible to bring a pegboard.
Oh, okay, good.
I don't know whether it's something to do with the education system or whether it's something to do with conceptualization, and I'm not picking on anybody particularly here, but in my general experience, blind people are pretty bad at math.
I love math.
Yeah, some people do. And in fact, one of my friends who works in Chile, he's actually right into math and does all sorts of stuff for the math department at the Chile University. But your general experience is that when you say maths, blind people will either whip out a calculator or their note taker that happens to have a calculator built in it, or they will try to avoid math at all costs because it's scary. There are subnet calculators online, and whilst the subnet calculators can give you the information on how to break up your subnets into the various sections, they will not allow you to check your work. So, for example, you will find that if you just trust what the subnet calculator said and you keyed in something wrong, you will have no way to check that up. And let me assure you that once you've subnetted a couple of hundred PCs and put in the wrong numbers on all 200 of them, you will not be very happy if you've got to go back and redo it, or especially if you've got to reconfigure a stack of routers. So it's like estimating. It's a good idea to have some idea what the answer should be in the ballpark figure so that you can actually be fairly certain that the answer you've gotten back is somewhere in the range of what you expect.
Oh, I'm sure. It's a lot like writing a program and not using subroutines and then going back and finding out that one of the lines in your couple thousand line program is not working.
Exactly. And is your microphone working, Curtis?
Are you still broken?
Any idea what the problem is?
It was a Bluetooth headset, and it was shutting its jaws down every time he opened up Skype. So we got rid of that, but his other microphone isn't working. I set the Skype to take from the Realtek high-definition audio input and all that good stuff. So it all looks right, but it isn't.
There's actually an add-in that comes with a lot of the Bluetooth stacks that integrates them into Skype, so that when Skype sees the Bluetooth stack, when the Bluetooth audio device comes up, the Bluetooth will actually grab hold of it and then hand it across to Skype. You want to disable that add-on because it will just cause you more grief than you can possibly imagine.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Think happened because it just completely threw jaws. But we got rid of the Bluetooth, and it's still not working. But I think that add-in needs to go as well to even let Skype possibly have a look in at any other microphone, hey?
Well, without seeing the specific machine and the specific Bluetooth stack, they all vary. When you can get Bluetooth to behave, it's really, really good. But my experience has been that that is not the majority of the time.
That's what I...
Yeah, that's a good idea. And then tell everything to use the USB microphone. That will probably save you a lot of grief. I mean, look, you've probably been through all this stuff before, but you're sure the microphone's plugged into the right input jack? Because sometimes if you've got microphone in line in, it won't go. But I'm sure you've checked all that stuff, so we'll move on.
Yep.
Apparently the Logitech desktop USB microphone is particularly good, from what I've been told.
Just get...
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, go on, Rich.
No, I was just going to say, how about just getting a USB headset with a microphone? The ClearChat Pro actually
works
pretty well.
The ClearChats are nice if you don't break them.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I'm using right now.
I had a problem with my ClearChat. The connection broke on it, so I ended up ditching that one.
This is often the case with those. You have to be very careful. They're not so clumsy, blindy, person-friendly. I did manage to keep one working for like 2 years, though, once. That's a personal record.
I'll have to keep that in mind.
I was talking about you and something, Grace, on chat earlier this morning, but I can't remember what it was, and you weren't here to defend yourself or not defend
yourself.
Was it
web-based firewall?
No.
Or web interfaces on firewalls? Really?
No, it wasn't. That didn't even come up. If anybody remembers, it was something I was going on about. You had some problems with something or other, and I just can't remember what it was. It was true, but...
www.
Oh, yes, not typing in the www and expecting it to go to the right spot. That's what I was talking about. You thought you could just leave it off, and sometimes it wouldn't do what you wanted because the www was different to the actual A record that the root of the domain pointed to.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. I do that some. It depends on the site, because some of them have the right ones and some of them don't. And some of them don't even want a www, so...
I think www.cisco.netacad.net now works, but it never used to for years and years and years. Does www.cisco.netacad.net work? I'm just about to find out.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. There you go.
Open DNS.
There is an example of a site that does not want the www, so don't put it in. I should probably add a shortcut to our Open DNS on the QCAT network.
No, you shouldn't, because then you can use it as an example.
Well, that's true. But we actually discussed that the reason for that was because some domains actually need the A record to point at the mail server, because certain broken mail delivery software will not honor MX records. And if the mail server and the web server are different machines, that will actually cause the www to point to one machine and the actual root of the domain itself to point to another machine, which is why some domains do it like that. Okay, now, anybody got any questions, queries about that IP address stuff? If you don't want to ask on channel, you can Skype us up and ask individually. Some people feel more comfortable speaking to us directly. They feel that asking questions in class makes them, I don't know, not so cool. We certainly don't believe that, but if that's the way you feel, you can ask us one-on-one. We'd be more than happy to help you and talk to you and help you out with any of the questions you may have. There's a Chinese proverb that I can't remember about that, but I'll find that for next week. Any
Just
questions,
a quick
queries
question.
On the IP stuff? Yes, Jonathan.
Will we ever come across the new expanded IP numbers that are what they're six sections instead of four or something like that?
They're not six sections instead of four. It is called IP version 6 or IPv6. Probably once you get into Discovery 4, you will come across IPv6. If you would like to know about IPv6 before that happens, yours truly did a fairly reasonable Thursday chat about IPv6 back in 2007. There is a genuinely held belief that we are running out of IPv4 addresses, but nobody knows when the transition of the internet to IP version 6 will actually take place, although it's worth noticing that from OS X 10.3, Windows Vista onwards, and Linux all have IPv6 support in them. In fact, I think Windows 7, and I have to check this, has some El Torito tunneling enabled by default, which is a method of tunneling IPv6 over IPv4 traffic. But yes, I did actually a fairly good Thursday chat on IP version 6, and that'll be in the 2007 folder of Thursday chats if you want more information on that.
Great.
Yeah, no, Vista and 7 do have some IPv6 support in them.
Oh, they definitely have IPv6 support in them. What my point was is whether it was enabled by default.
When you look in Vista and 7, you will see both in your ipconfig/shell, you'll see both an IPv4 address and a possibility of an IPv6 address.
Yeah, but I think those addresses are only link local, which means that they only work on the local subnet. What we need to do is get somebody to go to www.kame.net, I think it's kame.net, with Windows Vista or Windows 7 and see if they see the animated turtle rather than the regular turtle. And that will tell us whether IPv6 is actually enabled by default. Or it'll also tell you in text, too, that IPv6 is on. Yes, mine says it's a non-dancing K-A-M-E, so I'm using IPv4. Okay, any other questions on the Chapter 5 stuff? Is anybody finding this revision at all useful, or do you guys want to go to bed early?
I'm finding it useful.
Oh, very useful.
Cool. Oh, that's fine. As long as you guys are fine... Okay. As long as you guys are finding it useful, I'm happy to do it. Otherwise, you know, if you're not finding it useful, I'll go down to the cafe and have croissants and coffee and stuff. So we'll continue on with the whip through, and then we'll probably have one more tidy up lecture next week, like a short lecture next week with any questions that arise from this one, once everybody's had a time to listen to the recordings. And Grace is umming, so we'll find out what she has to say.
Yeah, I was going to say something. For anyone who is in Discovery 1 only, well, and ITE 1 people, they all know, we're doing role-playing tomorrow, so if you want to come and be a customer in our little role-play and our board tomorrow night, come on over to my ITE 1 lecture, and we will get you set up with role-playing. All I ask is that you either shoot me your MSN Messenger or be on Skype so that I can tell you what... your scenario is, without telling everybody else. So if you're bored, come and play with us.
Is this open for Discovery 1 or just ITE 1?
It is open for if you would come, you'd just be a role-playing student for somebody else to try and solve a fake problem that you supposedly had.
Right. I'd like to try my luck.
You're not going to get to roleplay. You're just going to be a customer.
Okay, I would just be the customer. Yeah, I'd like to do that. I'll come. I'll do that.
Well, you can certainly, regardless of whether you are involved, and you're certainly welcome to be involved, you're welcome to certainly come along and listen anyway, because it should be a little bit of fun.
Okay.
If you come, we'll find a problem for you to supposedly have, and you'll get to have one of the ITE students try their luck solving your problem.
Okay. Now I'm trying to remember what we did in Chapter 7. That's how memorable Chapter 7 was. Anybody remember what Chapter 7 was about?
Wireless networking. Wireless technologies.
No, that's why it's not mem-
Ah, wireless networking. Okay, right. Now I remember. Wireless networking. Right. Wireless networking is the stuff where you network without wires. You have wireless network cards. You have... Well, you've got to tell some people this, Kieran. Some people... Yes, but if you don't state the obvious, people won't know. Trust me, okay? Yeah, we actually had somebody who came into a computer store, and he went up to the counter, and he said, I want a wireless network cable. And my friend said, no, I'm sorry, sir, there's no such thing. Wireless networks don't have wires, therefore you don't have a wireless network cable. He said, well, I've got this router and I need a wireless network cable so that I can connect these two routers together by this port, and I need to have a wireless network cable. And my friend tried to explain to him again that he didn't need a wireless network cable at all, but the guy was absolutely insistent, so my friend went out the back and got a different coloured patch lead and sold it to the guy for $30. Okay. Now, wireless networks, we talked about using the 2.4 gig and 5 gig bands, the ISM, Industrial Scientific Medical bands. There was mention in the notes that there is a lot of devices that exist on the 2.4 gigahertz band, such as microwaves, garage door openers, alarm systems, etc. It's now getting to the point where there's lots of stuff that exists up on the 5 gig band too, but don't let that stop you. You have up to 14 channels if you're working on the 2.4 gig band. If you are using there are a number of standards. A works on 5 gigahertz. B, G and N work on 2.4, and there are N access points that work on the 5 gigahertz band. B runs at 11 megabits per second, G runs at 54 megabits per second, and I believe N runs at a maximum of 300 megabits per second, although I'd have to Wikipedia that one up. We do have N gear, but I only usually see 135 megabits per second between me and the access point, so I'm not sure what the theoretical maximum is, or whether I've set the channel width wide enough. You should try and ensure that your wireless networks are not on the channel of any other wireless networks, and a lot of routers and devices have site survey tools, you can go into those devices and actually see what devices exist on which channels, and then you try and find a channel that is not occupied. Channels 1, 5, and 10 are non-overlapping channels. If you are in the US, your default channel range is from 1 to 11. If you are in Australia, your default channel range is 1 to 13. If you're in Japan, your default channel range is 1 to 14. You basically set up a network with an SSID, which is a network name, and you join that network by either scanning for the network and connecting, or specifying the SSID, and that will allow you to join that network. Wireless networks have some security concerns because the signal is wireless, i.e. no wires, therefore you need to look at authentication and security. Authentication being how you authenticate and make sure you are who you say you are, and there are a number of ways of doing that. There's 802.1x authentication, which is where you use a radio server. There is also a shared key. Most wireless networks are set to be open so that the authentication step doesn't have to happen, generally speaking. Then you have encryption, and you have numbers of methods of doing that. You have WEP, which is the Wired Equivalency Protocol, which uses 64 and 128-bit keys, but it actually ends up being 56 and 104-bit keys because it doesn't use the high bits in any of the keys. WEP is considered insecure. It's fairly easy to break a web network. Hence the there's an article on the Register called Gone in 60 Seconds that talks about how to crack web networks. WPA, or the Wi-Fi Protected Access, and WPA2 are more robust methods of encryption. They use keys that change on a regular basis, which is TKIP, or the a temporal key integrity protocol, which means that the keys change over time, but it's a funkier way of saying it. If you just said the keys change every now and again, it wouldn't sound anywhere near as cool as temporal key integrity protocol. Sort of makes it sound a bit Doctor Who-esque. You can also do 802.1x over WPA, and you can authenticate with radius servers and stuff and do centralized authentication. You can also do encryption with certificates, and you can prove the ID of the various stations by handing out certificates and private and public keys and all that sort of stuff. It is recommended that you use the highest level of security that all of your devices support, so generally speaking WPA2, although some devices will only support WPA or WEP. One of the drawbacks with WEP is that the hashing algorithm to convert the password into the four web keys is not standardized among equipment. I've seen at least two algorithms that do the hashing, and it is often necessary to specify the keys in hexadecimal. And if you want Grace to jump up and down and have a squawk, you set up a web network with some incomprehensible hex keys. Personally, I have
is
no trouble with...
Is it worth the trouble?
Certainly is. Well, I mean, if your devices only support WEP, if you do not turn on encryption, anybody who is driving past your house, sitting in your backyard, loitering on your front patio, or within, theoretically, 100 metres of your house can connect to your network and steal your network bandwidth. So having an open wireless network in 2010 in a relatively populated area is not a good idea. I think we have 6 wireless networks around our units now. When I moved in 2006, we had 1, which was mine.
Yeah, I have quite a few around me, and most of them are unsecured networks.
It's not as critical in the States because you're not generally charged for bandwidth like you are in Australia. But if you are in Australia and you are unlucky enough to be on like a 3 gig cap or a 1 gig cap or something, having people steal your bandwidth can then cause you to either be given a hefty internet bill or to be throttled to a very low speed at the end of the month. But more seriously, it can be a problem if people associate with your wireless network and then undertake illegal activities, because you are actually responsible for what happens on your internet connection. And if somebody else jumps on your wireless network and starts looking up child porn and all that sort of horrible stuff, you could find yourself in a lot of trouble. So it's generally a good idea to secure your wireless network. We do know of somebody who I will not mention the name, who basically goes and steals internet access, refuses to pay for his own internet access, and he just associates with unsecured wireless networks. I'll say it again, and I did say it in the wireless networking lecture, this is theft of services. And it's a very dangerous thing to do, and it is actually, you are stealing somebody's network resources, and it can result in criminal charges. And you might sort of say, well, it's okay because nobody will ever find me, but you can actually build a direction finding antenna, and once the person is associated, you can track them down and have a talk to them about why they're associated with your network. I never actually did it, but one of the things I had considered doing was loading up a computer with every piece of spyware and Trojans I could possibly find, wire it up to an open wireless network access point, and then when everybody associated it for the free network access, they would get rather a nasty surprise. However, I didn't want to go to jail for doing that either, but it was a fun thought. They would certainly get more than they paid for. Okay, in Chapter 8 we talked about integrated services routers and stuff. We talked about the routers that have a wireless access point, a switch, and a router embedded in them. We also spoke about the venerable Linksys WRT300 or 310N. We talked about how these routers had web interfaces and that you should change the default passwords on these devices, the default SSIDs, and you should also secure wireless networks. We also mentioned that if you manage to associate to a wireless network on an integrated services router, generally the wireless access was in behind the firewall on those devices, and that if somebody managed to compromise your network, they would have internal access to your network bypassing any firewall that would exist on the device. A firewall, of course, being a device that limits packet flow to and from the network, either using packet-based rules or stateful packet inspection. Stateful packet inspection being the method by which only packets that are associated with an originated outbound connection are allowed back through the firewall, or inbound packets to certain ports that have been forwarded are allowed through the firewall, so that's what stateful packet inspection is. We talked about software firewalls, which are software that runs on a workstation, such as Zone Alarm, Viper Antivirus, Norton Antivirus, whatever else, Windows Firewall, the good old venerable Windows Firewall. We also spoke about hardware firewalls, which are a specific device that actually sits between your network and the rest of the internet. There are some specific firewall devices that can do this stuff, or you can actually install software onto an old PC such as PF-Sense or Astaro. And Astaro is A-S-T-A-R-O. It is actually a commercial firewall, whereas I believe PF-Sense is still free. There's also a whole lot of other standalone firewalls such as Loaf, Linux on a floppy, and various other firewalls that you can load up from a network, from a flash stick, flash card, CD, etc. Interestingly enough, and I'm not going to talk about this too much, your firewalls can either be configured by a number of methods. They can either be configured by a web interface, or they can be configured by a command line. And at the moment, mine is configured by a command line, which doesn't make it very friendly to other members of the household that don't like the command line. Watch this space. You can build your own firewall, which is what I've done. That's a fairly tricky thing to do. Or you can use the one that's embedded in your router. And then Chapter 9, we spoke about the troubleshooting procedures, how you solve problems, either working from the bottom of the OSI reference level, physical upwards, say checking link lights and stuff, or whether you work from the top of the OSI reference model down, application level, etc., or whether you work from both ends of the OSI reference, or if you start in the middle and work outwards, which is what we call divide and conquer. Okay. Anybody got any questions on any of the stuff I've covered this week? That was an extremely flying revision of Discovery. And if any of the stuff I've said is not in the final exam, we make no representation, either expressed or implied, as to the quality, merchantability, or fitness particular purpose for any of these revision lectures. But we do hope some of it will help you with your final.
Does a firewall slow down your network, and if so, by how much?
That depends on the firewall. Generally speaking, that question is a bit like saying how long is a piece of string. However, if you have a firewall, there is a certain amount of processing time in figuring out whether the packets should be accepted or denied. But generally, we're talking time ranges in the millisecond range, so it might take a millisecond or half a millisecond, or perhaps on a slow firewall, 5 milliseconds to figure out whether a packet should be accepted or denied. So it can slow it down a little bit. Generally speaking, however, once the decisions are made, these are done fairly quickly in hardware, and the actual speed of your internet connection is usually so slow that the processing time involved in the packets actually travelling through the firewall is negligible. I believe it takes about 0.1 of a millisecond for packets to travel through my firewall.
Yeah, thanks very much.
So, yes, it does slow it down, but I don't think you'll have time to make a coffee.
Instant coffee.
Yeah, well, yes, that's right. Yeah, instant coffee, if you have the coffee before the packet travels through the firewall. the other thing I was going to point out is that you can actually do what we call traffic control and quality of service, and that is where the firewall or the network appliance is actually responsible for limiting the rate at which traffic travels through the network, and it's also responsible for prioritizing certain traffic above other traffic. And that is often used on networks, for example, where you want email to have priority over web traffic, or whether you want everything else to have priority over all the torrents that you are currently running. Alrighty, any questions, queries on any of the stuff I've covered today? Any general questions that people would like to raise? Otherwise, we will be available on Skype, which we usually are. And we would like as many people to turn up on Friday as possible for this Brett guy. If you can make yourself available, we would really appreciate it. Any other pending questions before I hit stop on the record, or any other things that people want to talk to me about on lecture? Otherwise, you can Skype me, email me, whatever.
I've got a question.
Nine, are they accessible?
Sorry, go ahead, Melanie, I missed that.
I think last week you said the labs in 9 were not accessible, could not be done.
I do not believe the labs in 9... I believe get my negatives around the right way. I don't believe the labs in 9 are doable, and I will get back to you with a definite answer on that, but as far as I recollect, you do not need to undertake the labs in Module 9. I had actually vaguely considered rewriting some other labs for you all to do, but I think everybody's finding that they've got enough work to go on with as it currently stands.
I came across a term, PPP, which said it was point-to-point protocol. How does that apply in this course?
Point-to-point protocol is a method of transmitting IP datagrams from one point to another. It used to be used on dial-up links. So, for example, you would dial up your ISP and you would have a point-to-point... You're back.
My computer absolutely died. It was beautiful.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. It was awesome. I had to restart it twice to get it to do what I wanted it to do.
Have you got the front door open, or...?
Yep. Oh, and our fridge is working.
Oh, good. I have no idea what happened there. I'll have to look into that. I think there might be a dodgy connection in the power board. Anyway, back to Jonathan's question. Point-to-point protocol was used for dial-up and stuff, so getting packets from one to end to the other. Now, point-to-point protocol is often used when you connect to ADSL, and it's actually called PPPoE, or point-to-point protocol over Ethernet. And the reason we use point-to-point protocol over Ethernet is so that you can establish a session with the terminal server. You put in your username and password, and then your ISP bills you for either the time or volume that you use when you are connected. So PPP is still used today quite regularly. Generally, you set up an ADSL connection with point-to-point over Ethernet, VPI 8, VCI 35, and you put in your username and password, and you log on to your broadband. Generally, that is either done by the person who installs your broadband, or it's done by the CD that came with your broadband modem, or you do it yourself by following the incomprehensible instructions printed on a piece of paper and then end up tearing your hair out while talking to the ISP tech support to get it up and running.
So it's irrelevant to this course?
It's not irrelevant. I mean, the only thing you need to know about it, however, is point-to-point protocol gets IP packets from one point to another, and it's usually used for dial-up or broadband. That's all you need to know. Okay, anything else before I hit stop?